Right, the weekend right after July 4th.
Yeah, right. Come on.
Why does it say turkey on it?
Does it?
Yeah. Probably because it's made in turkey.
I think that's the chicken pillar over there and the steaks on that
steaks?
Side. Veggie pillars over
there.
Pillar of veggies.
Yeah.
That's the thing about the afternoon class after lunch and after the picture.
I know.
You really get it.
Which I missed.
You missed the picture?
I can't believe I missed the picture.
I know.
Left the lunchroom. I thought, well, I'll roll up my sleeping bag and stuff ready to go.
Yeah.
Then I go out and get the picture taken. I go out the door and it's like everybody's walking away. I'm like, did they already take the picture? She goes, yeah. I'm like, oh.
Yeah, it was super fast this year.
Yeah, exactly. It was really
fast. Do you remember last year with the sun?
Actually, wasn't in it last year.
You were leaving last year.
No, I was here. I went for a swim in the lake.
It looks really low.
Yeah.
Last year I had my wetsuit on and everything.
Wow, is that cold?
Huh? Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that.
I thought you were saying you were skinny.
No.
Wrong kind of camp.
That'll be next year's.
And our camp gone wild.
I get enough stuff from me being here, the notion of being that kind of camp. I don't think I could live that one down.
So there's the
it gets exhausting. I'm just not telling anybody. I'm just like, I'm on a retreat.
Yeah.
People respect that a lot.
I was going to band camp in high school, so I'm used to it.
There's a lot more mischief in band camp in high school, let me tell you.
Yeah, it's in here.
I thought he was here.
I heard his phone ringing. I see him. He's just outside the door. This one. This was a last minute addition to the handout, so it's not stable.
We'll suffer through it.
Yeah.
Oh, this is just the
one. You have your handout? You got them all three? Three pieces?
The audio? Or
no,
oh, no, I'm still waiting for them to come around.
Oh,
sorry,
I'm
missing
a
picture. I'm missing everything here. It's all right. It's not nice.
Thanks for bringing my case down, by the way.
Yeah, no, it's so easy to spot.
Yeah.
The one with the handle, the strap that broke?
I can't get the clamp off. The clip from the strap is hung up in the broken metal from the part that snapped off.
Yeah,
So I'm going to have to work with pliers and pull that off. They're designed to be hard to take off.
Clearly.
I learned my lesson now. I'm going to replace that strap every couple of years.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's the second one.
I'll have to look at my...
Yeah, that's the second one I've had that's broken exactly the same way.
Did you buy that case from Calvin?
Yeah, I did.
I have somebody else's name on mine. Some in the government, some McGowan or something like that.
You bought it?
I bought it used.
Oh, you bought it used.
I bought it with this.
Yeah, they stopped putting names on them for a while.
I contacted. They're not in Canada anymore.
This company got sold.
Right.
And the people who own it...
they haven't done that. They haven't started doing customization.
They're basically milking the brand for everything it's worth. And customer service is out the window. Quality is out the window.
I got an email back several days later saying, yeah, not yet. We're not doing that.
Yeah, if you've got an old Colton case, you're lucky.
Yeah.
Used or not, with somebody else's name on it or
it's
not.
It's solid. I think it's a good case.
Yeah, that's now survived two 3 foot drops.
You didn't buy the $300 cover for your Kelton case.
I don't get me started. I used to buy them for those cases because the way those wear is the edges wear off the Tolex and expose the plies, and then the water starts working on the plies and they separate, and the case is worthless. So for those, a case cover it makes sense. I actually saw Little Roy Lewis years ago was selling a hard shell case for your Colton case.
Nice.
I went up to him. I said, Roy, that's a joke, right? No, he had one. He had one. It was about this tall, and there was this much padding around the case.
If you ship it on planes a lot, I guess.
It's better. Actually, I've got friends when they travel, instead of checking their banjos, they ship them. Because you can insure them.
Yeah.
You get better insurance coverage from FedEx than you can from the airline. And they're less likely to be damaged. People ship banjos all the time. This has been back and forth to Nashville.
I like the Artful Dodger. I got mine on the plane every day so far.
I do too. The real.
Well, did you knock on wood?
So far.
When you just said that.
I know. Yeah. Next time it won't happen. I duck around them. Yeah, you can't take that. Okay.
The real trick, this is my last bit of only somewhat banjo-related useful information, is get a case with a shoulder strap that doesn't break. And when you walk into the security, not security, because security just, they'll put anything through, as long as it fits in the box. But when you're walking up to the gate to get on the plane, have the banjo over your shoulder on the opposite side from the ticket agent with the wide end forward. So when they look at you, it looks like a hat box. Because the whole neck stuff's behind you where they can't see it. And then you give them your ticket and keep walking, and they're not going to turn around to look at you. They're already taking the next person's thing.
Exactly. And don't make direct eye contact.
Right. Yeah, that part, that's actually okay. I've said, have a nice day, and talk to them, and you walk through.
But what happens if you don't have a place for it?
You have to make sure you get on the plane early.
Okay.
So the overheads are reasonably clear. And if not, a lot of the time they'll do them in the coat closet. Once you're on the plane, the stewardesses figure it's no problem. You going to take my place? You're going to take your sign.
Well, I've heard other people just say, it's just a guitar. Reason a banjo is, it's anathema. That you're going to get it out and start, cripple creaking all over them.
Cripple creaking like that. Can I use that?
You can.
I'm going to cripple creak all over you.
Okay, you're a creak.
That song actually has lyrics. I didn't realize that. Casey, during our coaching session, broke out and was singing it because I was kind of being negative about Cripple Creek.
Going down, because I can't stand playing it, and she
just was like, "You should sing it then."
That makes it slightly better.
Yeah.
But
I've never heard anyone articulate it like you did in terms of just like it doesn't. There's no tension.
There's no tension. It's a square tune.
Well, I just the slides just. Yeah, it's exhausting. So that's just me.
Yeah. What else is a a square two in his pocket on a breakdown. There's no tension. There's no rhythm tension in Foggy Mountain Breakdown. It's all square rules. The closest thing to it is the actual. Right, that's actually a forward roll, but it only lasts a measure. Can I do 5 minutes on Foggy Mountain Breakdown?
Yeah,
okay. Let's do it.
Do a 5 minute riff on Foggy Mountain Breakdown. Yeah. You know there. There's a low break for Foggy Mountain Break, yep. And there's a high break.
Right.
And the high break, there's actually two high breaks. There's actually three high breaks for Foggy Mountain Breakdown. All of them end pretty much the same way. But they're mainly variations in the way that he played them different times that he played, that he recorded the tune. One of them involves this 10th fret choke. Actually, two of them involve that 10th fret choke. And one of them is... there on it, it's all the same. But that's, I call it the Perry Mason break. But if you, nobody here is old enough to laugh at that joke.
I know what Perry Mason is, but I don't get the references.
It's the theme song. Has that kind of shape. But the other way that he played that was like this. If you look at the right hand on that, that's the classic Foggy Mountain Breakdown roll, right? Index, middle, thumb middle, and then a forward roll. Use exactly the same right hand with this choke. It's exactly the same right hand roll.
Why do they use first and thumb?
Actually, this is great. That's a great.
It seems easier to use the index.
But it isn't. It seems easier until you try to do it fast. Do this for me. Do this right here. Everybody do this. Yeah. Put your fingers out like this and wiggle these back and forth as fast as you can. You feel the tension in this part of your hand? Feel that?
Yeah.
Okay, now do this. Back and forth with your index, with your middle and thumb.
Middle
and thumb.
That's not as easy as it sounds. It's easier with resistance.
It's easier with resistance, but you don't get that tension back.
It's easier than this.
Right, it's easier than this.
Yeah, boy, that really gets you out of
here. Yeah,
gets
you all
the way
out.
So
that's why, as a rule, and I almost consider this a rule. I went back. This is one of the things I had to correct. All over the place in the book when I got the first edition. If you have the chance, you know that you don't want to use the same finger twice in a row, and you can't play thumb on the fifth string and then thumb somewhere else right after that if you're playing eighth notes. But any place that you can get away with playing your thumb, you do it up to the second string, and that's not just in Foggy Mountain Breakdown. That's in any tune at all. You get so much more control and power out of your thumb. Plus, thumb against another finger is a much more balanced, as far as muscle use, much more balanced movement than two fingers. There's a lot of reason for doing that, and it all comes down to speed. Classic sort of intermediate. Issue that I have. So when I get students who've been playing a while, one of the biggest problems that I have, just as a class of problems, is things that work slow that don't work fast. And so, I figure we'll have a. We're riffing for the moment, but we'll get into the topic shortly.
No, come on.
And this is a class, but. I was just figuring that I was giving it more or less till 2 o'clock for people to actually arrive. The people who actually read the schedule and think it's 2:30 are out of luck.
Pay no attention to the man.
That's fine. If you're used to playing, a lot of people when they play will bring their thumb down and play the third string. So they'll play thumb on fifth, thumb on third. And if they play a forward roll sometimes, in the middle of a tune, not thinking about it, they'll play thumb, thumb, middle. Which works great as long as you're playing slow. You don't need this pick at all. Start speeding that up,
yeah.
And after a while, you start tripping over your thumb. And people don't realize it because it works. They learn a tune. It worked for them. Now they're trying to play it faster so they can play with jams. It doesn't work. And that's a real mistake. This issue of using your index finger, middle, that alternation, that's not a mistake so much as it's just technique that doesn't hold up as you start to speed your playing up. So,
yeah. On that note, do you ever do many forward rolls where you start with your thumb?
Yeah,
you do.
So thumb on thumb inside or thumb on the fifth?
Just in general. Somebody earlier was doing that. It's just like, I'm so used to stuttering. I always do my stutter step on these two.
Do you? So you do in the index middle thumb. It depends on what note you're trying to bring out.
Yeah.
Right. You often will want the note that you want to come out of that roll. You want to play that first.
Okay.
And so if that's on the low string, that's on the fifth, fourth, or third string, you're probably going to use your thumb. It's just something you have to get used to.
So then it's thumb, index, middle.
Oh, you just... Yeah, there's... not that. It's just these three.
Or you can move this. I call the two, sort of like when I was marching in the Navy, it's the stutter step to get you.
Oh, so you're thinking about three. It's eight notes. Okay, here. That's,
so the two.
This is not going to take a whole hour and a quarter to do. So I'm going to do a little question and answer from the whole weekend before we actually get into the topic. You're thinking about forward rolls in an eight note.
Right.
Frame. You want to get away from that and have your rolls sort of ignore the measure boundaries. So if you're thinking about that, what's going to happen is that every phrase you play is going to be eight notes long, and when
right.
And there'll be an interruption in continuity from measure to measure. The most powerful thing that happens on the banjo, I said this last time in relation to backup, but it's doubly true with lead. The most powerful thing you do with the banjo is set up a pattern that doesn't resolve at the end of a measure, and then keep it going.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Keep it going into the next measure, because everybody in their musical experience is used to important things happening on the downbeat of every measure. So if you defy that, then you've done something. You've created tension. You've made people pay attention to you. So if you think about forward rolls as eight notes, yeah, you're going to have to drop something somewhere. But in the course of dropping that extra note, dropping that ninth note, so you fit into the eight note measure. You're creating a space in that roll. Whatever momentum you have in terms of TIM, TIM, TIM is broken when you do the TM. Whether you do it at the beginning or the end doesn't matter, because if it's at the beginning, it's just the end of the measure before. So it's like roll, 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 stop. Roll, 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 stop. Roll. And every one of those stops is equally spaced.
Could you play an example of that? I'm having a hard time. I don't really, I'm not really getting that in terms of adding the TM is ending
okay.
at the measure.
What you have to do is, I can do that. Actually, this is a roll that I teach. This is one of my week one rolls. Right? I give people a sheet the first week they're teaching, and I give them the standard. I give them the forward roll. I give them the forward backward, the alternating thumb. All of, like six of the standard rolls that are in every book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I give them a seventh roll. And the seventh roll is a forward roll, but the same way that a forward roll is three notes, two notes. T-I-M, T-I-M, T-M. This is two measures long, and it's T-I-M, 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 T-I-T-M. An eighth note measure is six notes to forward roll, and a little bit of square to resolve you to the end of the form. This is 12 notes of forward roll,
yep.
And then four notes at the end of square. And nothing's more square than T-I-T-M.
Oh, that's yeah. Okay.
And so that gets you to the end of the form, because when you finish four forward rolls, you're halfway through the second measure. You've got four notes left. You need something square to fill it, because four notes is by definition is square. So you just do a forward roll. Do that double forward. So here's an example. I'll play a regular forward roll over and over. And right. So every time I hit a downbeat, I'm playing my thumb. Right. Okay. So you see what's happening. Every measure is the same.
Right.
Okay. So here's the double forward. So the one now, which was always on the thumb before,
right.
My first one here is on the thumb.
Right.
My second one is on the middle finger.
Right.
And then here's the exercise. Here's where it pays off, because if you do that roll, you want people initially to do it very even. You concentrate on the space in between the notes and on the volume to make sure everything sounds the same, and then. You make one note emphasized. So I'll make my thumb emphasized. Right.
Well, it's a syncopation.
Right. But that syncopation is there whether I emphasize it or not.
Okay.
Right?
Because that's if you emphasize your thumb each time, it sounds like the drone. It sounds like a drone note, right? We talked about that, I think, on Friday.
Well, this is a little different because the thumb is playing two different notes.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the earlier roll, just did the other
one. Yeah. So there's the rhythm of an eight note forward roll. And you just hear it center every time. Of your seat because it's going on so much longer,
right.
And it works with every finger. If I emphasize my middle finger, in that, the index, right? You hear that? As soon as you hear that fifth beat. It just grabs your attention. You've just violated one of the basic beliefs everybody has. The fifth beat, which is the downbeat of measure two.
Right.
You get that. Right. You're waiting to hear that note, and you put your foot down, and I'm playing this, and you lift your foot, and there's the note you're waiting for, that you should have been putting your foot down on. That tension is what makes it work. And that's what's in songs like Fireball Mail and Shuckin' the Corn.
Appreciation for that song, then. Okay.
Yeah, The song, what you want to do with songs like Fireball Mail and Shuckin' the Corn and Ground Speed is figure out what the melody is. Because even Cripple Creek has words, but even if it didn't have words, it would have a melody. All these other songs, Fireball Mail has words. And Roy Acuff sang it, it goes back to the, you know, it goes back to the 20s at least. Hawkshaw Hawkins, I think, was. It has words. Groundspeed doesn't have words, Chuck and the Corn doesn't have words, but they still have melodies. Right? So you want to hear those words and or hear those melody notes, and you want to bring them out, right? The difference between Fireball and Nail, between, let me do Earl's breakdown, because I've done Fireball and Nail a million times this weekend. Right, if you don't know the melody, it's kind of hard to pick it up. There's spots where the thumb's doing all that work. It's really easy to pick it out there. But then you get up to, yeah. Slow, and it's actually harder to bring the melody out of a banjo tune when you're playing it slow, because you can actually stop and listen to the spacer notes. But when you play, you try to bring those extra notes out. You try to bring those melody notes out. Play Home Sweet. This is, you know, the one more example. This is actually tying in with the real topic. So, Home Sweet Home, right? Be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. Quoting, I think, Bugs Bunny. If you play it flat across, getting a lot of junk, right? There's a lot going on in there, and you're hearing every bit of it.
All right.
Okay, the melody, this is like groundspeed. The melody's all on the first string, and Scruggs treats that with a backward roll. And so the easy way to emphasize the melody in Home Sweet Home is just to put a little more energy into all the middle finger notes, all the first string notes. And this is down on the bottom. You hear the difference? It brings the melody out. And it does more than that, because the melody, this is that 8-note, 16-note thing again, because the melody here, this to me is his breakthrough song. When I interviewed him, this is the song I asked him about. Because, right, all backward roll. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Right? But it's really going 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. And you hear how the notes just fall all over the place against that count. And so what happens when you speed that up? You get past a threshold where people can't stop and listen to every single note you play anymore. They're just too fast. So what they do is they listen to whatever you tell them to listen to. How do you tell them? You make those notes louder. You set this level of notes. And anytime you want them to listen to a note, you just bump it up a little bit. And that's the pattern they hear. And when you do that and it's fast, they hear two things. They hear the melody, but they also hear the rhythm that comes out of that roll. And that rhythm, because it's 3 against 4, is deliberately really funky. It's really syncopated. And you say, yeah, it's syncopation. like no big deal. It's syncopation. Except,
well, some people who, like me who have a hard time with that.
I play very robotically,
very exact.
And there's a breakthrough point. You've got to hit a point when you're playing banjo where it's no longer about every note. It's about the patterns, and it's about the framework of the beat that the patterns are played against. Because those two things are very different. The song is going along at one rhythm, and the notes, even the melody notes in the case like this, are going along at a completely different rhythm. And the two of those superimposed drive people nuts. So you get Home Sweet Home.
Can you tell the Mike? Door?
That's a break of bar. You
can have.
It was getting in on Friday. You should have been here Friday. Help me get all that stuff in here. So you play fast, play that song fast, and what you should hear is nothing but Home Sweet Home. And you should hear the rhythm that goes along with it. You might want to tap your pedal on with this just to really get the flow of that. That's what happens when you let those rolls forward, backward, doesn't matter. The key is that they're three notes long, and you just let them go. Here you're going 1 2 3 4 1 2 3 4 1 2. So it's not until the middle of the third measure that you switch directions and break the backward roll.
Because that would be 12. So
that's more. That's actually now 20. And so it has 1 2 3 4 2 2 3 4 3 2. So it's on the 2 beat of the third measure that you switch your and all of what happens because the roll sustains you. The roll abides.
So eventually,
I don't even know how we get started on this topic, but I'm glad we got here.
He dropped me here in Lowell last year at the thing.
That's right.
And we never finished the conversation,
right.
So I guess it was just ready to come out.
This is the continuity. But this is good, actually, because this also leads us right into doing breaks.
There's just a whole class on that.
There's your TIM, TIM, TIM.
I know. Well,
is it a name for rolls? Or, you know, like they have forward roll backward?
I call that one the double backward. No, double forward roll.
Double forward.
Got a grease vein. Nuts.
I heard it. I was trying so hard not to be an 8-year-old.
I know.
We're in good company.
I'd explain that, but I'd get in more trouble.
No, let it go.
But it's just forward. I mean, we're thinking of forward as always having to resolve, but it's really just forward.
Everything eventually has to resolve,
right.
Because when you start a new phrase, the new phrase has to make sense. It has to sound like rhythmically it's coming from someplace that you can work from. But then from there you just play. Here's a perfect example. Everybody has had the experience. You turn on the radio, it's the middle of a song, and it sounds like noise. You have no idea what's going on. All of a sudden you hear a beat, that makes sense, and the song just, it's like taking taking a piece of cardboard out from in front of your face. All of a sudden, the rest of the song makes sense. And you can even think back to what you heard that was noise, and now that makes sense too. Right? So that, all that's happening there is that when you turn the radio on, you can't tell where the downbeat is. You haven't heard one yet. And so you don't know, it's exactly the same notes you're used to hearing. It's the same recording you're used to hearing. But
until you hear
something that tells you where you are in the measure, it makes no sense. And that's why you can do it up to a point. You can do this kind of rolling. And what you're doing is you're creating the danger of slipping into that incoherence, that's that place where you've lost the downbeat. But then, and that's tension. That's tension resolution. That's you're creating that tension by doing that. Then you resolve to a downbeat, and boom, you're resolved. And now everyone knows where they are, and you can start wandering off again. So you have to do it in little bits. Two measures, three measures. The longest one I've heard in Scruggs is in Folk on the Banjo, and that's 3.5 measures before it resolves. And it's tense, I'll tell you. I recorded it. I liked it so much I had to slow it down and learn it. And once I learned it, I had to record it.
So whether or not we knew it, we all started playing banjo so we could screw with people.
That's it. You're playing with people's heads. Banjo is actually applied psychology. And it's a graduate level course, believe me. So that actually leads us into some of the important stuff in here. So let me start. Let's get on topic now. That's not right. These are actually put together out of order. But let me talk before we start going into the handout. Your goal, this is kind of a companion piece to the last session I did, which was on backup. In backup, you're trying to fill time with rolls and deliberately avoid playing anything melodically interesting. Because anything you play that's interesting is going to compete with whatever you're backing up. With leads, it's completely different. You're trying to fill time again with rolls, but at the same time, you're superimposing a melody structure. You're getting a melody across. A good break will allow people, when they hear it, if they've never heard the song before, to walk away humming it. And it's really important, especially when you're improvising, because you often improvise outside of the stock melody of a tune. So if you decide to go off and improvise to a harmony or improvise a counterpoint, even people who know what the song is aren't going to know what you're playing unless you make it clear to them. So there are two things you're going to start with when you're playing a break. One is the chord structure, just like anything. Chord structure is on top, and the other is the melody. And the melody, some of this will be repetition for some of you, but melody is built out of the chords that you're playing, and in more specifically out of the scales that those chords are also built out of. So when you play a section of a tune that's played against a G chord, when you sing that section of the tune, the notes that you are singing are most likely to be coming from the scale. So if it's G, it's one of those notes. This being bluegrass is based in blues. And what makes blues blues is that there are two extra notes we deal with. And that's the flat third. In G, that's B flat.
Dun, 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 dun.
The flat seven, which is in the G scale, it's F natural. So if I play G scale,
you
don't play either of those notes. If I play those notes, that's not. It almost sounds like a minor scale, but it doesn't. It almost sounds like a major scale, but it isn't. So it's
all
this.
All I can think about is King Tut.
Right.
That's the start of King Tut.
Right. Right. Which is written by a banjo player. So
exactly. Some of our first exposure to banjo music.
Oh, I know. I was playing. At the end of the jam session last night, this morning, I started playing The Crow because I was in that tuning, and everyone looked at me like, "What's that?"
It's like triple D under C sus 4 or something. Isn't that the one that's really complicated tuning?
It's a really easy tuning. It's double C. So
okay.
It's standard G, drop the fourth string D to C,
okay.
Raise the second string B to C.
Oh.
There it is.
Oh.
So it's G, C.
I didn't realize it was so easy.
It's G, C, G, C, D. And nobody knew who it was. They were all guessing, like, Jens Kruger? Who wrote that?
Steve Brewer. Yeah, that album.
Anyway, without getting too deep into pentatonic scales. Right? Those notes, the scale notes and the flat 7 and flat 3, make up most of the notes you're gonna sing in the melody of a tune. When you change chords, the only thing that changes about that is which scale it is. So if you're in G, it's the G major scale. When you switch to D, you're in the D major scale. When you go to C, you're in the C major scale. It's all the same things. The scale notes, flat 3, flat 7.
So it's just a flat... It's really... Okay, I'm just looking at the C scale, the G scale.
Oh, yeah, okay, this is...
What you mean by that.
Right.
It's the one that's hit on the Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol.
Now the Do, Re, Do, Re, Mi.
Plus the 7.
Plus the flat, plus the blue notes.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So when you want to play a break, you've got to bring these two things together. Chord and the note, and the scale notes. You do this for two reasons. One is when you're looking for the notes, it's a lot easier to find the melody notes out of the notes of the scale, which there are only 7. Than it is trying to find it out of every
all 13,
out of everything that's every fret of every string. So as soon as you narrow it down to those notes, you've narrowed it down to a manageable number of guesses. And once you're there, the other questions are: does this note go up or down from the last one, and how far? And when you're doing this is ear training, and this is just something that, as a musician, you learn to do. So, if you're unlucky, you learn to do it without anybody telling you, and it just happens because over the period of years, you get whacked in the head by notes enough that they finally, some of them, make it through, and you understand what's going on. But this is something that's actually worth practicing. To just take the banjo out and. Listen, think of a melody, think of a tune, and start on one string and play the whole melody on that one string. Start in the middle so you can go in either direction. But so if you're that one, I didn't start high enough because I can't go down. So there's Blue Ridge Cabin Home, all on one string. And what you want to do is be able to hear and not guess, but know. The notes go up or down? Will they go up? And how far? That's 2 frets. That's 2 frets. That's 3 frets. It's a different sound. you get used to those intervals and how they sound, and that's how you judge tunes. Remember that a melody is not made up of actual notes. A melody is made up of relative changes from one note to the other. So I can play. I can play that starting here, or. Right, that sounds terrible now. Right? After listening to that.
Yeah.
But. Sounds fine now, right? As soon as your ear gets tuned to what key you're in, everything sounds fine because all that matters is that first note. Right? You can describe a tune just in terms of you know, roadmap. Start on a note, go up two, go down, go up two more, go up three, down one, right. And that's the tune. And once you do that, it doesn't matter what note you start on. That set of directions works.
It's just like, you know, capo.
It's like playing with a capo,
you know,
exactly.
This is my end is here, and my end is here.
That's right.
But it's also good with a singer.
If
a singer wants to start in a certain key,
right,
then you can just do the whole note.
That's right. And if you're used to playing with a singer who sings in G, and you play the song a certain way in G, and you start playing with a singer who sings the same song in A, you put a capo on, and you do exactly what you did before. And it's just like what happened when I moved the starting note.
You're just starting
in a different place, but all of the motions are the same. That's why banjo licks in general, there are two kinds of banjo licks. They're the kind that use a lot of open strings, which are very specific to a chord and to a key. And then they're the ones that use all fretted notes. Right. And those licks, right? Those licks work anywhere. Close my eyes to do this. Right? That works anywhere.
But the open ones won't work anywhere, will they? Hmm? The open ones only work once.
The open ones will sound different because if you move them the fretted notes somewhere else, mm-hmm. the open notes don't change along with them.
But if you capo,
they work. But yeah, but it's how things are relevant.
But they only work. They only work near the capo.
Well, no, they work. Yeah. Anything that works. I mean, okay, that's close. Right, I can't do. Because that note, because there are a bunch of open strings in there.
And that would apply if you were capo or not. I mean,
that's right.
Capo just moves the nut. That, you still have open, closed.
Exactly.
Strings.
But all relative to the capo now, everything, you know, it's like relative to the nut when there's no capo on.
Right.
Just a classic.
Sorry, I had to get on the road at 2:30.
Yeah, okay, no problem.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
See you next week.
Hey, good talking to you.
Sure. Read Masters of the Five-String Banjo, which is a book that everyone should get. It's interviews with absolutely everyone who had anything to do with the invention of, or development of bluegrass banjo up until the mid-80s when the book was written. There's an interview in there with Snuffy Jenkins, who was a major influence on both Earl Scruggs and Don Reno when they were kids. And he talks about Dear Old Dixie, which, you know. So they and he says, well, you did that in the band. And Pappy Sherrill, who was their singer, said, we did it in F because that's where he sang. And when you listen to the tune, this, you know, this is another one of those banjo instrumentals that actually has words. And you look at the way this tune is written, except for the fifth string, it's all fretted notes. So you take that, move it down two frets. With that tune, because the fifth string actually, the G still sounds good against F. And in fact, there's one place in the G version of Gerald Dixon where, and you do this really awkward thumb over to get the A note in order to make this is F, G, this is C to B. That's an A, so it makes it a B seventh chord. Okay, you do that in F, it's B flat to A. What do you put in A to make it an A seventh chord? You put in a G. So it's a strange chord for that spot. But it would have made perfect sense for Snuffy to put it in the key of F. And when Earl played it, he moved it up to G and, you know, just dealt with the inconvenience of having to fret that note. But you see how everything, you move the tune, and as soon as you get past the first note or two, everything sounds right.
So I could start Cripple Creek here.
Well, except for that one slid note, everything else is open.
Then I can't.
You can't, right?
So it sounds great.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's because the relative pitch is what matters, and that slide isn't the same relative to these other notes as it is if you do it two frets higher. I think that chord was in the Bluegrass Man.
All right, yeah. I think I get it.
Just that slide goes, that's a B, and that's supposed to be a B.
Right, yeah, you slide.
And if they're not, then you're done.
And
so,
in fact,
right, because that matches with the open strings. So
right.
That's a G chord.
That's right.
Ooh.
Yes.
I learned something.
Plus,
that's why that works. And we can't move it just down because it doesn't match. It's not, you know, A chord or whatever that is.
Right. Right, because you're not moving everything.
Sorry. I'm really, really proud of myself.
No, that's good. This is good. Okay, so going back to the way this works, in every chord, you're going to get the melody notes out of those scales. So you want to know where the scales are. If you're playing G, the open tuning on banjo is a blessing and a curse. It makes it much easier to play, but it also makes it much easier to take for granted what you're actually doing. And what you're doing is you're working inside the framework of a chord, of a major chord. The fact that most of the note, or that half of the notes that you have to play a G scale, are open strings, is gravy. But you still... But what it does is it makes you think like all you have to do to play something is put down one finger, and the rest of it will take care of itself. Well, it's only taking care of itself because you've already taken care of putting those strings at the right pitch. So when you play a G scale, you're going to play a lot of open strings. You're going to play G, A, B, C, D, E, F sharp, G on the fifth string, or G here. this is where the second page of the handout is important. This is where this comes in.
Which is the second page, and so
it says scales in open position.
It's that, okay.
Okay. So one, what you'll notice is that also that there are places where you can play the same note in two different strings. So I can play that B on the third string, fretted, or I can play it on the open second. I can play C on the fretted second or on the fretted third. I can play the D either on the open first or on the fretted second. All of this without going above the fifth fret, which is one of our goals here. E is on both strings also, and the chord. So you've got to hold. You start here on the third string. You got a whole G scale. Plus, you're on the third string, which means you can also go down. So you've got a G scale that goes down from a low D. G with options, and the best thing about the options is they give you the option to play of which finger you play the melody note with, particularly the notes that are on either the first or second string. The first string notes you can play with your middle, second string notes you're going to play with your index. So when you're thinking about constructing rolls and rhythm, which string you put that note on is going to make a difference to, because you're going to emphasize that. It's going to make a difference to what rhythm you get out of the roll. So anyway, that's G. C. Here's where I want you guys to start playing along. Your option, if you want to take it out. Here's the key. Now we're actually in a place where we're playing notes, scale notes out of a real chord, meaning a chord we have to work to form. When you do that, what you want to do is play the scale notes, moving as few fingers off of the chord form as possible. The reason is when you're actually playing a melody, you're not just going to play the melody notes. You're going to roll. You're going to play other notes along with it, and it sounds a lot better if those other notes will harmonize with the current chord. And the best way to do that is to have them be in the current chord. So if you play C, right? So if I play slow circle, deal broken, by and by, low by and by. That sounds fine if I just play one note. But if I play, right, what's wrong with that picture? Right, you by, Lord, by and by, you don't hear that C chord. But if I do by and by, there's the chord change. And having those extra notes in there lets me play both the melody and the chord at the same time. So here's what I want you to do. You start out, play your C chord. Now the melody note, the root note in the C chord is on the second string. Right? So we're gonna go up. We're gonna go C. I'll play the open first string. Right. That's the second note of the C chord. Put that down again. Play the first string again. Now you've got your pinky out here to take care of other notes. Put that down on the third fret. Right. Now play the fifth string. Okay. So there's five notes of the C scale. And by the way, you can play the D by using your pinky on the third fret of the second string as well. That's the same note that you get from the open first. So we've done that. The only time we've had to move a finger is directly to get a melody note. But when we lift it off the first string to get the open D. So we can also now go down. So start on C again. Play the C note. Okay. Play the open second string. Right. Put that note back down. That finger. And now the next note we need is A, which is going to be the third string second fret. How are we going to get that?
Just
two rules. Two things you want to think about. For efficiency, you try to always play. You try to only move a finger along the same fret it's already on. If you're using a finger on a fret, that's where it stays. So in a C chord, anything you want to play on the first fret, you're going to play with your index finger. Anything you want to play on the second fret, you have a choice. You can move your middle finger off the fourth string, move your ring finger off the first. But when you're playing, your middle finger almost always hits the first string. So almost every roll you play is going to have first string in it, which means unless you have to get a melody note on the first string, you want to keep that fretted in the note that's in the chord. So that when you hit the first string, you're actually in the chord.
Could you just say that again?
Your first string is more or less trapped with whatever note is in the chord, because every time you play a middle finger note, it's going to be the first string.
Right.
So if I use my ring finger to move over to the third string, the first string is this kind of odd note.
That's an advantage of using the full complement of chords.
That's right.
As opposed to the two or three finger.
Right. When you're doing this, particularly at this point, you want to use the full chord just to get used to it. Mm-hmm.
What songs put the melody on the first string?
Home Sweet Home.
Oh, well, yeah, that Home Sweet Home does. Almost any song that goes up high enough.
In that case, your middle finger's doing all the melody.
In that case, yes. But remember that you're not playing consecutive melody notes. This is.
Right.
I'm going to need your recording from this one too. My disc just ran out.
We're still going. Yeah, we're good.
I see it jumping. You're going to play a melody note, then you're going to play some fill, and then you're going to play another melody note.
Right.
So the fact that you're playing all the melody notes on the middle finger doesn't mean you're playing all your notes on the middle finger.
Right, but I'm going with the fact that you said it's trapped. It's trapped a little bit here.
If the melody note is on the first string, then it's not trapped. Then you're going to alter the middle finger. You're going to alter the first string to get the melody note. And the rest of the chord, all the other strings, will be your support.
Mm-hmm.
Those will be your roll notes. And here, actually, we've already altered the first string twice. Right? We've opened it up to get D, and we've put the pinky down on there to get it. So from C, play C again. Open second. B. Now put that down. Move your middle finger over to the third string. Right? Move your middle finger back and play the third string again. Third string. Put your middle finger back where it would be in the C chord, and now play the third string. You play an E chord. Okay. Now get your pinky all the way over to the fourth string. Fourth string, third fret.
Fourth string.
Right. Okay. Lift that off and play the fourth string again. Right. Open the fourth string and play it again. And you're done. That's the lowest note you've got. So you've got C, B, A, G, F, E, D.
Yeah.
It's one of those annoying.
Finish.
Right.
Come on. Right. Too much tension.
Right. So now you can play tunes. one of the, you know, Alan Shaw did Lady of Spain, which normally is a punchline for accordions, but... That's right, but there's the melody,
yeah.
And that's the first chord change, going to the D minor. Right, all of that comes out. Right, and you're doing a lot of moving back and forth with these two fingers because those are the melody notes you happen to need. This one, the ring finger, never moves off the first string, and it becomes part of every roll.
That I had in terms of, and it's completely related, about the fact that I play a version of I'm a Pilgrim,
right,
in which I go and then I do something else, and then I go into the what I just learned was the C7th, but right. I've been not doing the full chord, and I've just right. been reaching over.
Right.
You're actually, if I understand your argument yeah. correctly, you're saying, hey, keep your fingers in this chord position
right.
and continue the roll so you're within the chord.
Right.
And by saying that, then the C7th would really stand out even more
right.
because it will match with that. It
right, and right, because you're playing all the notes that support. Okay. That seventh note, that
yeah.
B-flat, makes no sense without the rest of the C chord. And what you're doing is actually you're taking a C chord, just like we just added the scale notes. You're adding the flat third. You're adding the blue note. Actually, that's...
And then it transitions into G.
Yeah, that's actually... Right, and then...
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
I wonder, say, good Lord, and it's not made by hand.
Right. Well, I just want to
right.
make sure I understand. That,
right,
and
that,
I think I got
right.
it.
Yeah. And it's the same technique. You're getting that melody note
right.
out of the
I'll
chord position.
I'll play with it because right. I've been having trouble with that transition anyhow because it just seems empty. And I wrote it. I mean, I wrote my rendition, but
right.
it just, you know.
Yeah.
I think that'll help.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to go on to D, and D is really sort of the payoff here. And we'll get to why. But so play D chord. And a D chord, if you think about it, is just a C chord moved up 2 frets.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because down here, you don't need to fret the third string, because relative pitches, it's 1 fret behind the second string. Move up here, 1 fret behind the second string is fretting. Was fretted the second fret. So a lot of the same rules should apply to D that apply to C. And in fact, the root note of the D chord, like the C chord, is on the second string. So that's D. It's also the open first. So a lot of these notes can be gotten just like the G scale in 2 different places. So there's D. Let's go up first. So it's D. Now move your index finger to the first string, and lift your pinky. So just index finger straight across to the first. There's E.
And which one are you hitting?
First string. Right. Put the chord back together, and play the first string again, and you get it F sharp. There's the 3. Play the 5th string, there's the 4. So we're up, we've got the first 4 notes of the D scale. Now we go down. So go back to your D, go back to that 2nd string. Okay, now you move your index finger to the 2nd string and uncover that.
Pick up the third,
right? Okay. Now you notice what happens here. We've actually changed two strings.
That's a C sharp.
Right. That's a C sharp. Right. We've actually changed two strings. We've changed the second string because that's where the melody note is. And we've changed the third string because we needed the finger that was covering the third string in order to get that C sharp. So now if you played a roll against this position, you would just avoid playing the third string and everything else would fit.
Right.
Avoid
playing the third string. Right. What?
Avoid playing which string? Third? Avoid playing... Oh, wait. Avoid playing the third string because that's where your index finger came from.
Oh, neck is
right.
Okay.
Now that you can't judge the fifth string on this because the G note on the third on the fifth string isn't in the D chord. So when you play it, it's going to sound weird. Particularly when you're playing the fourth fret F sharp on the first string, because then those are one fret apart, and they sound terrible.
Unless you
evolve
it very regularly.
Right. Or if you play them in sequence, they work.
Nine Count Hammer has a couple of those.
Right. Right. Okay, so we're down to the C sharp. Now put the D chord back together. Mm-hmm. And move your ring finger over from the fourth string to the third. Right. There's B. Which, by the way, you can also get by just lifting your finger off the second string.
Yeah.
Same note. So I'm just showing you that there are places where you have options. Okay. Put the chord back together and play the third string again. Right. Now G, open the third string. Right. Okay. Put the chord back together and play the fourth string. F sharp. Move your index finger to the fourth string and cover it. Uncover it. Right? E. And put the chord back together but leave the fourth string open. D. So now you've got a whole D scale going from the second string down. Down to the bottom of the fourth string. And you can go up. Right. So that's your D scale. And this is a little outside of the scope of this class, but I just want to take you a little further down this path because we're so close to just being able to do everything. Okay?
This is the secret of
everything I'm about to tell you. You notice when you play this, there are only two open strings you're playing. G and the low D. Well, the low D, you're playing the octave, so let's leave that one out. You can get that note by cheating a little bit, by stretching up one fret and getting it on the fourth string. You can also, not quite as much cheat, by if you hit a melody where you need that G, if you don't want to play it on the open string, you just alter the melody a little bit and play a different note in the scale that harmonizes with the G. This happens all the time because when you deal with some notes, and I'll show you why in a second. It's part of that universal truth I was mentioning. It's easier to improvise around a melody note than it is to stretch and get it. So here's where the payoff is. Now we've got a way of playing a D scale. With all closed notes, which means all relative pitches. So if I move that, if I want to play a G scale, well, I take that D-shaped D chord, move it up to G, and do exactly the same thing I did down here. So everything I play, that scale.
So that D
goes
shape,
everywhere.
That D shape goes everywhere, so that it would go that the F shape would go everywhere.
So the, yeah, there's you can do exactly the same thing with the F shape.
Okay.
One note to cheat.
And you wouldn't do it with a bar chord and bar code.
You can do it with a bar chord. Two ways. That's one way, and that's using the one finger bar and playing up. Mm-hmm. You can also use a multiple finger bar.
Yeah. But you get the minor, so.
Right, get the blues up. It's all there.
But it would be the same, you know, going from the bar at 5 to the bar at 7 to the bar. Okay.
Right. Okay, so here's one of the important things you want to do to take away from this class. Each of those chord plus melody note positions is something to memorize. It's like memorizing the original chord shapes. These are just, you know, there are more of them, but in order to play the melody, this is what you do. And you want to be able, if you're thinking about the melody and you know you're in a C chord and you know the next note is a B, you know what to do. Right, you know, it's an A, you know what to do. And so those are, it's like when I say play a C chord and you all just lock on to exactly the right thing. These chord melody combinations work exactly the same way. You memorize them and you'll just be able to play anything.
Well, and that also helps with all the fretting, you know, the fretting class too.
Right.
Of being able to actually, if you know it, then how to actually manage it.
Yeah, you're right, exactly what you're doing. You're managing these positions. So let's take Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Right? Simple three chord song. And let's just play it. Let's just play the melody. So, will the circle, so where's that low? Everybody's got that low D. Will the circle, so just play that much. Will the circle. Be unbroken. Right. You got it?
I don't have it.
You don't have it? Okay, let's will let's open fourth. We're in G now, so the only notes we're gonna fret are the actual melody notes we're playing. So
in this one.
We're actually in this G. We're working with three chords here. One, this is one. That's it. We won't need this one yet. So start on the fourth string. Fourth string open. The up two frets. Right. Circle. Open third. B. Strangely enough, it's B.
What is B? I was getting ready to say.
B, that's A. Second fret, third string. Unbroken. Back to B for B. Broken. By, and that's B again. By, and is A. So third string, second fret again. By, and. So let's just take it that far, because the next note's a chord change.
Right, so how do you do this if you don't know where the melody is supposed to
this
go?
This is what I was saying before. Take
you know the melody.
Your exercise.
This note.
Right.
This note.
So the first exercise.
I know the melody, but I don't know what notes they are.
Right. Well, you do because you can sing it.
Okay.
So here's what you do. What I said initially was find the melody, find the first note of what you sing. So let's say it's D. Find it in the middle of a string so that you can go up or down depending on where the melody goes. Will the, and find the, sir, and you'll be hunting around because you're still not hearing this, but the sir, you find it note by note on one string, which is going to let you both hear and see how far apart these notes are. And what will happen, you do it a note at a time, so you're really painstaking at first. Do it a note at a time and go back after you find note three and play the first three notes. When you find the fourth note, play the first four notes. And just keep building it note by note like that. And every time you build a note, you're gonna start hearing a different interval. Or the same interval in a different context. Right, two frets up is gonna sound both the same and different depending on where you play it. And two frets up is gonna sound the same but different than two frets down. But you're going to get used to the sound of all those intervals, and that's what you need. In order to play a melody, you've got to be able to hear it this way. And to hear it this way, you just it's training. It's like learning anything else. You were over years, I'm not saying people were born with it, but over years, everyone learns how intervals work, because if you don't understand intervals on a subconscious level, you can't sing. But what you have to do is take that subconscious understanding of how far, how much you contract your vocal cords to go up that distance, and translate that into how many frets you move in which direction on the banjo. And that's just practice. Okay. There's no other way to do it.
I play piano.
Practice.
I understand.
Well, okay. Well, there you are.
I play the vocals. That's how I read the music. Right. But it's not translating to the banjo at all.
Well, every key on the piano is one fret on the banjo.
Right.
So if you're used to going from D to C, that's two keys, D, C sharp, C. So if you're playing D here, D sharp, C, or C sharp, C rather. So I think if you're playing the piano, you've got the entree. You do it on the piano first. Maybe if you've always played from sheet music, you may not have to deal with this. But when you're listening to the music, and just trying to go note, okay, where's the next note? If the music's not telling you, you have to find it, and that ear training is what will help you find it. That's really important. That until you do that, your banjo playing is going to be very, very difficult to advance. That's a terribly constructed sentence.
Do you have any songs that are stuck in your head from childhood?
She's got songs that were stuck in her head from last night. Yeah. Just do that, and that's okay. What you have to do.
I have my first bluegrass banjo book was a Mel Bay.
Yeah.
All the songs were
Thank
in
you.
Tablature and musical notation.
Yes.
That's how I learned to read music.
Yeah, notes. Actually, that's
a
good
thing.
And that
helps with the basics right here.
Right. So you can, if you can sight read music.
I don't think you get that book anymore.
You can... They don't take much out of print, I'm hoping. Yeah, so if you have a book like that, and the Scruggs book does this, but that's on a much higher, you don't want to be playing banjo rolls on the piano.
Right.
But if you read through it, you can see note and fret. And as long, the trick with that is when you switch to a new string, everything changes. So you really want to stay on one string, so you feel the intervals, and that'll make it work. So I'll work through this through the rest of the song with you, but this is going to take some work at home to really get it working. You good with this? No, same thing, and it's you just have to develop the ear. And now the other way to do it, and you can do this with the song, because you're limiting. When you're doing this, you're out there. You're completely unsupported, because there's nothing to tell you which of these frets is in the scale. When you're doing the chords, when you're working for the chords, because you've already worked with this handout and memorized those positions. So this does reduce the amount of guesswork that you need to find the notes. So now we get to the C chord, and there are four melody notes on the C chord. It's by, by, Lord, by, and after that goes back to G. So put down your C chord. Third string. Here's by Lord. That's up two frets from there. So move your middle finger from the fourth string to the third string. Bye, Lord. Bye. Back to where you were. So put that back. Right, back on the third, back on the fourth string, play the third. Bye, and. Right, and now you're back to G. Bye, back to the G chord. So just. Here's another trick. Not an absolute rule, but it's pretty usual that when you change a chord, the first note that you play, the first melody note you sing, is not just going to be in the scale, it's actually going to be one of the chord notes. So that reduces your guesswork now. When you get to bye, it's not just one of the seven notes of the C scale, it's one of those notes, one of the notes of the chord. And it is. It's the third string. Bye, Lord, bye, and bye. Back to G. And now this is like the beginning.
Well, G, you're back in G. So
you're back in G.
G.
So now you're playing G, right? Right. And that melody note's D, which is in the G chord.
Right.
There, and now it's like the beginning. Well, the circle is just like, there's a better. Just like the beginning. Home waiting. Right, the melody changes after that.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Right. There's a better home waiting. So, home waiting, that's, you're going right up the scale, right up the chord. There's a, that's no, that note's fretted. But the rest of it, better home waiting. All open strings. Right? In the sky, Lord. In fact, it goes longer. In the sky, Lord. Now, in that note comes from the D chord. Put your D chord down. Yeah. Put your D chord down, and right. And the first, love that feeling. In the first note of the chord is likely to be the first note you sing against the chord is likely to be one of the chord notes. In this case, third string, it's A. In the ring finger over to the third string. That's not ring. Ring.
Ring.
Straight. So let's see what we got. We got C chord. Bye. C chord. Bye, my Lord, bye. This old middle finger movement. Bye, Lord, bye, and bye. Move your middle finger over to the third string. There's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord. Use your D chord. Use your full D chord to get these notes. So your full D chord's going to go that one, yeah. And now you, those are all, those both notes are on the third string. And then sky, open third. So now what's left? You've created, you know where the melody is, you know where the chords are, you know how to get the melody out of it. Now all you need to do is add some rolls. And okay, let me give you one more piece of advice. There are two different kinds of notes that you can hit in most bluegrass songs. They're short notes. Well, and they're long notes. Circle. Be unbroken. By and by. Lord, by and by.
Got some time to fill.
Right, Yeah. So what do you do when you're playing those short notes? You can just play the notes. You don't need to embellish them. You don't need to add fill notes between them or anything. Well, that says it all, right? When you get to a long note, that's where you do your rolls. And the rolls, like we were talking about before we supposedly got on topic. Is it raining?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, shoot. Well, camp's almost over, so it's...
I guess you can do whatever it wants.
No, I got to pack up my camper.
So at the beginning, before we were supposedly on topic, I was talking about the rolls and about how you just play through a roll exactly as long as you need to, and then if you need to change fingers, you always have that one finger. Did I talk about that?
Yes.
The one you can skip the one finger.
No.
No. Oh God, that was last hour. Darn, I thought that had that whole thing set up perfectly. Okay, so here you go. I was sitting exactly in the seat. Flashbacks.
Yeah, more.
Yeah, I gotta get it. Really. So when you play, you get to that long note, and you just start doing forward roll. Make sure that note you're trying to emphasize is in there. And you could play, if you wanted to, you could play an alternating. You could play it square if you want. You can play anything at all that keeps that roll, that note, alive. How long do you play it? The best way to figure it out, people talk about counting. I talk about counting, but in this case, counting's really hard to do because you've got too much on your mind.
I have to sing it in my head.
That's exactly right. That's what you do.
The whole time, ever since they started playing banjo, I sing it in my head.
That's such a good habit.
That is the hardest thing for me to get people to do.
That's the first thing I did.
And it should be. It should
Which
be.
Which gives me it takes me so much longer to learn a song I don't really know.
Right, you have to learn to sing it first.
Because I can't sing it in my head.
Right, you have to sing it.
Because my head is, I think it's because when I was a kid, my dad used to drag me to all these country things, and all these, mm-hmm. I'm sure I saw Scruggs and those guys when I was a kid. Oh. And it's just in my head. It's just ringing in there.
Right.
All those notes are ringing. And so if I know the melody, all those other notes are just, they're bopping right along with it.
Yeah.
So it's like I hear the whole thing at once. Mm-hmm. But if I don't know the melody, forget it. Right. I can't do any of that.
Well, if you hear the melody in your head, and even better, if you're singing words in your head, you'll know exactly where to start and end things. Right? If I asked you to sing "Will the Circle Be Unbroken," everybody in the room, you would all stop the word circle at exactly the same time and go on to B, because you have that sense of rhythm. When you're playing these roles, you people listening to you aren't the only ones you're confusing. You're also confusing yourself. Where am I? Exactly. So what you have to do is start out singing to yourself what the song is. When you do that, you have to forget what your right hand is doing. You just let it roll, and come back to it when it's time to change. And here's the secret of that, because every time you do this, when you start a forward roll, you don't know exactly which finger you're going to end up rolling to, and it makes a difference because the next thing you do might have to start on a particular finger. If it's a first string note, it'll start on the middle finger. If it's a fourth or fifth string note, it's going to start on the thumb. And if the last note that you played before that is a middle finger or a thumb, you're in trouble because you can't play it twice. So here's the thing. This may sound a little interesting, but I'll try to explain it clearly. You're playing through a roll, T-I-M, a forward roll, T-I-M, T-I-M, T-I-M. Here's the measure line. Here's the beginning of the phrase. The next phrase starts with a thumb note, let's say. The note, the only thing you can't do before that, the last note of the previous phrase, is play a thumb note. Okay. So that could be an index finger or a middle finger. Look at the note before that. And that's going to be something. It'd either be thumb, index, or middle. Y'all know which. But it's only be one of those things. So worst case, this is the thumb over here. This is a middle. You've got an index finger to play in that spot. If you're playing forward rolls, you would be playing through that. You'd hit that middle finger note, and the forward roll would say, what am I going to play next? I'm going to play a thumb. All you have to do is change that one note from thumb to index, and now your thumb is ready to play this note, to play the first note of the next phrase.
So that would be T-I-M-T-I-M-I-M-I-T.
T-I-M-T-I-M-I-T. Because otherwise, I need the board. They gave me a whiteboard with no markers.
Yeah.
But your T is actually the start of
the T is the start of the next phrase.
Yeah, my brain just... I was hearing that it was an I am at the end.
Okay, here...
I think I learned my limit like 2 minutes ago.
let me use a visual aid here. We're getting pretty close to the end, but I want to get through these last couple of concepts because it ties everything else together. So let me borrow your whiteboard here. So here's a measure. Earl Scruggs used this pen, by the way.
Yeah.
Here's a measure, and there's T.
Right.
There's the first note of the measure.
Yep.
So you're... You're an eighth note from the end.
T-I-M.
The forward roll says, this is a note. That's the note you're trying to fill in. Did you ever see that? T-I-M something T. Right?
Why would it be something T at the end of this?
Wouldn't it be something something T?
No, this is... let me do that. So this is the right number. Right. I didn't think about making this a complete measure.
All right.
Okay.
That's
so
where I was confused.
There's one
two
and
of
right.
Right.
Yeah.
Two
sorry.
More.
There's one and two and three and four.
And.
It's so that and. What is that? It can't be a middle finger note because you just use your middle finger.
So it would have to be.
It
index.
Can't be a thumb.
It'll be index.
Right. And so even though you're playing a forward roll, so the forward roll is saying, put a thumb there. To keep the forward roll going.
But
you have to break the forward roll in order to make
that. But that measure started off
with
an
I. Because
as we rolled over boundaries.
Right.
You might have started out with
actually, yeah.
It should be an M.
That should be an M if this
all
is
right,
a
there we go.
Forward roll. Right. So here's the point of this. If you're one... If you don't have to even think about how to get out of that forward roll until one note before the end. That last note is you're guaranteed always to have one finger at least. If this is T, this could be either M or I.
Right.
So you have one finger at least that you can always put in that spot to line your hand up to play the right finger there.
Or you can just make it a rest.
Yeah,
or you can just make the rest. The trick with a rest, and this is...
I know, if it doesn't match, it looks like you've lost yourself, doesn't it?
It also, if you rely on rests, you end up putting them in that last beat of every measure.
It gets
boring.
Yeah, unpredictable.
Right, it gets predictable. So this is something you have to practice enough to finally have faith that it works. That you can always just play a forward roll and get out of it just in the nick of time. And once you can do that, that's really liberating because when you do that, it makes you feel like you can play anything. And in fact, you can because every pattern works. It doesn't matter where you start the forward roll, how many measures you sustain it. When it comes time to force your finger to a certain beat, you're one note away from being able to do it. Just play the right note before it, and you're there. So that again, just like the ear training, this is something you have to practice. But when you do it, it comes out. So. Will the circle be? So that actually worked. Will the circle? Thumb right before B, which is an index finger note. So the forward roll just carries me to the index finger note, carries me to the B. Be unbroken those are two beat notes, and so four eighth notes. Easiest thing to do is an alternating thumb, right, for each one. Or I, and this shows something else, that you can change phrasing just the same way a singer does. You do it with your fingers. So you could do by and by, or you can do by and by. And that kind of articulation of rhythm is what Scruggs went after. He said, I try to play all the syllables. And that's what he meant. He's trying to play the way people talk and sing. And the way you do that is you group syllables. There's a better, if you want, or a better home waiting, or waiting. It's all in how you hear it as a singer should influence how you play it. So once you get into this idea of shaping of making the rolls, and I would say stick with forward rolls for now, because first of all, it's where they're the best rolls in the world. they're all-purpose rolls. The only thing that really backward rolls improve on for is they're better at getting first string melody across. So play the rolls, and just you'll start feeling how to move the melody notes around, and all you're doing really is playing a slightly different roll. So let me just talk through the rest of these handouts, just so you know you got. I think we're probably you're probably not the only one at burnout. It's Amy, right?
Yeah, it's Amy. Okay. Yeah, I it's like I have a couple light bulbs and then I'm like.
It's the end, and they get dimmer and dimmer.
It was an awesome close to the week.
Yeah, no, this is great. This tied up so many things for me.
Oh, that's great.
I don't know if it's Georgia Rose.
Right. Okay. Well, let me start with the last page of its staple pair. What I'm giving you here is different ways of playing in Cabin Caroline the phrase waiting there for me. You can, and it's just what I was talking about. Waiting. You group waiting. Waiting there for me. Or you can do waiting there for me. Do the quarter notes.
There's so number six is exactly what you were talking about.
Waiting there for me.
Actually, it's 24. T-I-M-T-I-M-T-M-T.
Right, that's the idea. There is you're taking this that four note phrase,
right,
and you're just making it a three note phrase.
Right.
A standard eight note forward roll gives you a really syncopated way to present three melody notes.
I think the first part of Fireball Nail is like that too, I think.
Yeah, each note gets one element of the roll. So grandfather's clock, that kind of rhythm. But if you got waiting there for four quarter notes, it gets boring. Right, you pretty much can't do anything except play the quarter notes, unless you group them. Like waiting, that buys you an eighth note that you can use somewhere else. So you just play through these and see what you hear. If you can download the tablet of this off my website. Look at the message board for the address, and I'll post when the sound files are up too. But listen to. You can get the free tablet view, get TEF view, which is lets you play tablet files.
So this
just listen to these all these little phrases.
This phrase is in the key of D.
This is in G.
That's in G.
Yeah, the last what happens right after these measures end is a change, is a move to D.
Okay.
Waiting there for me.
Right, because you have so many open. There's right. So many open strings. I every time I see a 4 and 2, I always think it's going to be D
right.
coming up.
Right,
that's a bad habit. So,
right, the 4 is a melody note. It's out of the G, but it's actually leading you to the D chord.
Mm-hmm.
The 2 at in the second measure of each of these is actually the D chord.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's the A note from the D chord.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an F sharp, which is in G. So it's good.
It's an F sharp. Yeah, F sharp. The F sharp note is in the G scale.
Right.
Yeah, before people get too giddy, that actually
it.
Made sense.
I got that actually.
Okay,
I've
given you two exercises actually, two songs to try this with. One is Home Sweet Home in G, which is an unusual thing because Home Sweet Home is usually played in C or D. So on the third page of the stapled handout is the melodies. At the top is the melody skeleton of Home Sweet Home, along with chords. At the bottom is one way of using these rules to make a break for Home Sweet Home. The other thing on the separate sheets I gave you is the melody skeleton for Little Georgia Rose, which I've... You can get on the internet. Bill Monroe has done it. Seldom Seen did a really popular version of it in the 70s. Come and listen to my story, a story that I know is true. A little rose that blooms in Georgia, hair of gold, eyes of blue, way down the Blue Ridge Mountains. If you haven't recognized it yet, find it online. And the last thing is actually the front page of the stapled handout. And this is a shortcut that's really kind of handy. That just like the first note of every chord, it tends to be a note, the first melody note you sing against any chord tends to be in the chord. The first downbeat of any song is the first note of a chord. And it's going to be one of those chords. So every first note of almost every bluegrass song is in the opening chord. And the opening chord for most bluegrass songs is G. So what I've given you here is opening licks. A pickup measure to that first opening beat for leading to each of the open strings. So each one of them you have. So what that means is it's one of the best ways to sell a break if you're trying to make people think you know what you're doing is start on the right note. And so since there are only 5 possible right notes, I've just given you a way of kicking off any break to figure out what the first note. Will a circle... That's G. So you look up third string G. And you've got... That one I actually played into the opening measure. So, but there it is. So this gives you a nice... Memorize these and you've got a nice authoritative way to open any bluegrass song that starts on a G chord.
Which page is that?
That's the first page. The ones playing down the neck opening licks. And that's really the class.
Sure.
Thank you so much. Great way to end.
Yeah. good.
So, how do you use this again? The first page? I really did. I guess I stood up.
Okay, so listen to, yeah, standing up is bad, but the blood all goes to your feet. any song is going to start first downbeat on one of those songs, right. One of those notes. So, if I had the wings of an angel.
If it's a D, you want to do sort of follows this.
Right.
If it's I'll figure that out.
Right.
If it's just G.
Right.
Okay. I'll work on it.
Okay.
All right.